Hello and welcome to Season 8, Episode 13 of the Ubuntu Podcast. It's Tuesday, the 2nd of June, and we're going to discuss what's been happening in the news and in the Ubuntu community. I'm Mark, and joining me this week are Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And Laura and Martin are off on their respective holidays this week.
How dare they?
So instead, we have, from every other podcast, Joe Ressington. Hello, Joe.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Yeah, can't complain.
Excellent. Good to have you on.
So this not adds another one to the list of podcasts you're on.
Yep, another notch on the bedpost.
Yep.
Right. Awesome. Well, we've got a news-packed episode this week, so I think we'd probably better crack on.
Okay. Sounds like a fun-packed show.
Yes. So yes, in the news this week, Mozilla have decided to give up on making a $25 smartphone running Firefox OS. Apparently there hasn't been sufficient interest in a low-cost, low-spec device, so Mozilla are shifting their focus to create a better user experience.
So no more super cheap phones off eBay.
Right. Well, I don't think I ever saw the super cheap $25 phone off eBay. I mean, I've got the original Firefox OS one, the first one, and that's a pretty terrible experience. But the later one, the Flame, is quite nice. Oh, and I can see why it would be pretty horrible on the really, really low-end $25, you know, spec machine.
Yeah. Is the Flame the same as the ZTE OpenC? I think it's similar. And that was, I think that's about £30 or £40. And that's really pretty terrible. At least running Firefox OS it is. Running Android, it's actually quite good. So
the Flame was okay. I mean, it's usable. You can use it as a daily device. You know, you can play music, get your email, browse the web. There's a few games. You know, it does the usual stuff. There's a couple of mapping apps in there as well. I think it just doesn't scale down to really, really low end. You know, it can't really compete with the really old Symbian style or the Nokia Asha phones, that kind of thing. I just don't think it scales down that well. And to be fair, neither does Ubuntu scale down, but then we never said we would.
Yeah, interestingly, one of the things that's been mooted is apparently the possibility of running some Android apps on Firefox OS, which I presume would bloat it out even more.
Well, they're not alone in doing that, because Tizen can run Android apps, and so can Sailfish from Yola. And they both license some third-party tool that lets you do that, lets you, you know, run Android apps.
In theory. Actually had my hands on with the Tizen, the Samsung Z1, and the Android emulation layer is a bit ropey, to be honest.
In what way? Is it user interface, or is it just slow, or what?
Well, it's just slow. I think it's the case with that phone that it doesn't have the hardware to deal with it, because it's dealing with the OS. If you were to put it on a quad-core or octa-core phone, maybe it would deal with it. But you've still got that old problem of the Google Play services, so only a select number of apps will work with it. So you're very much limited to what you can actually use.
Right.
Yeah, it's a shame. I'm torn about the whole running Android apps on non-Android platforms, because I think, you know, you've got the problem that you don't have enough apps, and you know where all the apps are. They're over there in the Play Store. But and if you could tap into that to get like more apps on your platform, but the flip side of that is, all the while you're dependent upon Android apps, nobody's ever going to develop for your platform natively.
Well, it's like the Wine thing. That helped adoption of the Linux desktop. I mean, I know a lot of people wouldn't have moved over without being able to run certain Windows applications. And over time, those applications get an equivalent in Linux, and people have ended up... I mean, I don't even bother installing Wine anymore.
Mm. Yeah, it's a fair point. So, moving on. Joe.
Yes, so... Google have released an improved set of privacy and security tools that allow users to easily control what activity is shared and saved and shared with others. And these settings allow users to control what information is publicly visible on services such as Google Plus and YouTube. as well as controlling what data is stored from a user's searches. Now, colour me tinfoil hat, but just because they say that they're not saving this information anymore, if you turn it off, and I've done that, does that really mean that Google aren't saving it and somehow attempting to anonymize it? I don't know. I'm a bit cynical about it, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's interesting that it's one of those things like the things which are super handy but also super creepy, like where you type in something on Google Maps and then you bring up, you open your phone in the car and think, oh, where was that thing I searched for? And you press the search box on your phone and it's the first predicted search result was the thing you searched on your desktop for.
Yeah.
And you can actually go into the control panel and see your entire history of the things that you've searched for in the various applications and what they're profiling you on and so on.
There's always the flip, I'm torn between the convenience and the privacy. And that is super useful. Like, we sometimes have to go to dancing competitions with Sophie and we go to these random locations and, you know, I just type in the postcode on my desktop and, you know, if I pick up an Android phone and open Google Maps, I know that I don't have to do the search again on the phone. Or, you know, like in the past when I had a TomTom, I would get the TomTom out of the car into the house and turn it on and then type in the postcode just to make sure that it had the route, you know, so it knew where that thing was. And then I'd go and take it in the car and off we'd go. Whereas now I don't have to check it on the device. I can look at it on the screen on my computer and then know that it's okay. It's going to be there on the device. I'm going to be all right.
But at what cost?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had quite a bit of fun a little while ago. You know the voice search thing in Android where you press the little microphone button next to... Well, I didn't realise, but in the dashboard, you can go and have a look at every search you've ever done with that.
And actually, everything you said.
You can replay all the audio files. And they're all stored on their server, and you can see the playback.
They're making a robotic Alan Pope voice.
Well... Yeah, it actually sounded really good. It didn't sound like heavily compressed or anything. It sounded really good. And I was like alarmed at the weird like recipe ideas I've been searching for and stuff.
Your wife's going to start getting phone calls from you talking in slightly odd phrasing.
To try and get my PIN number or password or something. So I tried this privacy check thing and I went through and there's loads of settings you can flip on and off. And some of them pertain to other Google properties like Google Plus and YouTube and stuff. And there's a setting in Google Plus that you can get to through this nice dashboard that says whether other people can tag your photo on Google Plus. Like when they upload a photo of you, should it automatically prompt them to say, that's Alan, right? And in the dashboard, I turned that off. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Turn that off. The minute I go back to Google Plus and look at a photo, it immediately pops up a dialog box and says, hey, do you want me to turn this back on again? Surely that completely defeats the whole point of this thing if it's just going to nag me to turn the thing back on again. It was ridiculous. So I've got mixed feelings about this thing.
Yeah. And next, Lego has announced Lego Worlds, a Minecraft-style open world game where the user can manipulate blocks in the world to create virtual Lego models. Well, that took them long enough, didn't it?
People would just stick to real Lego.
Or real Minecraft, for that matter.
Or both, yeah, true.
Apparently, previous attempts at doing something like this have been hampered because they're worried that people are going to make models which look like naughty things, and they have to get people to police them. Which, to be fair, isn't entirely unfounded. There's if anyone played the game Spore, which was you created a creature from a single cell and evolved it, and each time you evolved, you could add bits, and then you could share them. You could share them with other people online and then they would turn up as like competing creatures in their world. And of course, people would make them look like certain things and then they turn up in a child's game somewhere. And so they then had to actually have a policy where someone would go through and make sure the thing you were uploading didn't look like certain things.
Which is, you know, understandable because Lego is like very family friendly.
Yeah,
but it's really hard to stop people doing horrible things on the internet. It's really hard. Is it available for Linux?
Pass.
I don't think it is.
Raspberry Pi, maybe?
No, I don't think so. Moving on. Dutch company Nerdalize, which is a bizarre name for a company, maybe it's fine in the Netherlands, has announced a product called eRadiator, a server installed in the home, which can be used to provide free heating. The servers are from a distributed cluster of cloud hosting, putting the waste heat to good use in countries where constant heating is a necessity. Homes installing the eRadiator must have fibre optic internet connection and an exterior wall for installation, plus €500 for the setup costs. So basically, you're buying a server.
Well, you're housing a server for other people to run stuff on, and then
pay €500 for someone else to put their stuff in my house?
Because then, rather than it heating up a data center somewhere and having to be artificially cooled, you just use the heat.
Right. Yeah, that's fine. Well, yeah, that's great. But that heat was being generated anyway, and I'm saving them money because they're not having to pay for air conditioning in a data center. So there is no loss to them. I am paying them for having the server in my house. I would quite happily buy a server for €500 to get in my house and actually do something compute, like, for myself, put own cloud on it or whatever.
Well, that 500 is probably for the guys to come and drill the hole in your wall, because when you turn it off, it doesn't actually go off. It just gets vented out. That's why it needs to be on an external wall.
Ah, right. Okay. Right. Oh, so it doesn't. All right. I assumed that it had to always be heating your house. So you only wanted it if you lived in, like, you know, the Netherlands, not Netherlands, Scandinavia. That's the word I was after.
Yeah. Mm. No, it's constantly on, but you can just flip the switch to off, and then it starts piping the heat out into the atmosphere. Clever.
Right. Yeah. Mm. Well, it's a nice idea, even if it isn't the, you know,
use it for something else.
Useful thing. What's next, Joe?
Exciting Ubuntu phone news.
Ooh.
Tell us, Joe.
So the Ubuntu Insiders group was invited to an exclusive Hangout call. And I saw Jordan Keyes posting about this on Google Plus, and I was rather jealous. And it turns out that the Meizu MX4 is going to be given to all of those insiders who got the BQ 4.5 phone. And also news that the MX4 is going to be shipping in Europe via an invitation-based scheme, which is
nice.
Quite exciting.
Yeah.
And there's also going to be an Aquarius E5 made by BQ, which is slightly higher spec, slightly bigger screen, and that's going to be €200.
And this one, this isn't going to be a flash sale thing. This is going to be one you can just buy off their website.
Yeah,
which is good awesome. News. Yeah,
I love learning about this stuff from the insiders. Rather, we don't like all this information that they've been given out to these insiders. They're like properly insiders. Most of the company don't know about all this stuff. We hear it from like random blog posts from people in the community. It's quite good fun.
Oh, well, something that you are going to be able to tell us all about, no doubt, is this fabled convergence device.
Ah.
Oh, yeah. So this is going to be manufactured by BQ as well, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, this is another device that's separate from the E4.5 and the E5. It's not available yet. It's a brand new device. It's not a repurposed one of their existing devices, and that'll be available later in the year, apparently. Mark mentioned it at the Ubuntu Online Summit, but apparently later in the year there'll be a converged device.
Is it going to beat Microsoft? That's what I want to know.
Beat in what way?
Beat to the market first.
Oh, I don't know. When's theirs scheduled to hit the market?
At some point later in the year.
Ah, well, sure we'll
the great it. Phone race.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll see.
Yes. Mm. And finally in the news this week, SourceForge, much maligned for its fake download link adverts and suspect installers, has taken a further step into irrelevancy by hijacking accounts previously used by the GIMP and other FOSS projects and adding so-called crapware to the Windows version's installer. So this is where it installs the GIMP or whichever other piece of free and open source software you downloaded, and then offers to kindly install some rubbish proprietary stuff to give you adverts and slow your computer down. SourceForge has posted a response to this story, insisting they haven't hijacked the account. It was abandoned and their actions were taken for the good of the GIMP Windows project. And they've now made a GIMP installer available from SourceForge that only installs the GIMP without additional offers.
I like the way in the notes you've put offers in inverted commas. Nobody wants these offers.
No, it's like when you get a Java update from Oracle, and they also offer to install the Ask toolbar.
Mm.
Everyone's favorite browser add-on.
Mm.
Yes.
It's such a shame because, you know, I remember using SourceForge and what was that, Fresh Meat, and places like that to go and get tarballs and unpack them and install stuff, and you trusted them. And now you absolutely can't trust anything you get from SourceForge because it may have some nonsense bundled in in order to generate revenue for a site that's, you know, basically failing.
And it's especially disingenuous when you've downloaded a free and open source piece of software and the stuff that it's offering you isn't.
Yeah, it'd be perfectly fine if it was non-free. Are you saying if it was proprietary? If it was
well,
Skype?
No. I'm just saying that you're going to SourceForge and you're downloading something. You're agreeing to download a piece of open source software, and then it's saying, "Oh, and here's some other stuff."
But
by the way, it's got
a
horrible proprietary license.
Who've already decided on their fate. They don't do this in a Linux tarball. Linux tarball doesn't come with, you know, the Ask toolbar, probably just because it's too hard to do. It's just like not very easy to do that, I think.
Yeah.
But that's what probably about Windows? The only reason they don't do it. It's because it's hard.
What about Windows users who are trying to sort of dip their toe in the open source world? They've heard of this open source thing. They want to try it out. And then this is their first experience of it. It's really not very good for that.
That is really
bad. Awful. Yeah. They're terrible, terrible people. Really terrible people.
Owned by Slashdot, aren't they?
Opinion. Well, yes. And there was rumor that the owners of Slashdot and the owners of SourceForge, the same company, that stories were getting buried on SourceForge and so on. And
Slashdot.
Yes. Sorry, what did I say?
You said buried on SourceForge.
Ah, okay, buried on Slashdot. Anyway, it's a shame.
Yes.
Moving on.
Right, that's the end of the news. And now it's time for community news. So I wonder what's been going on in the Ubuntu community over
Nothing
the past
at all.
Couple of
Move
weeks.
Along.
Anything?
Nothing
anything you
here.
You guys have heard about? So yes, what you may have seen on some Ubuntu news sites and other various tech news outlets is there's been a bit of a spat between the Ubuntu Community Council and Jonathan Riddell, who we have spoken to in the past. He is was previously employed by Canonical to work on Kubuntu and has always been a major contributor to the Kubuntu project. I believe has a position on the Kubuntu Council and is currently employed by Blue Systems, who are the new sponsor of Kubuntu since Canonical let it go. And he has been asked to step aside from his leadership role of Kubuntu by the Ubuntu Community Council as a result of what they have said is behavior that basically doesn't meet up to the code of conduct and makes him difficult for the Community Council to deal with him, and they say they no longer recognize his leadership position.
Which he doesn't recognize himself. He says that the Kubuntu Council doesn't have a leader.
Yes, well, it depends on which particular. I think he was seizing on a particular word there. I think the email that Mark Shuttleworth sent backing up the decision of the council described it as a leadership position, which I think it's pretty clear he has. Mark Shuttleworth referred to him as the leader of Kubuntu, and then he said, "No, I'm not the leader of Kubuntu. Kubuntu doesn't have a leader. Therefore, he's got nothing to step aside from," which, to be honest, I think is willfully misunderstanding. The initial communication did quite clearly say leadership, not leader. But that's, you know, up for debate. But there has now been the initial response from the Kubuntu Council was to back Jonathan's position, basically because there wasn't a public sort of discussion as to why this had happened and what Jonathan was said to have done wrong. And the Community Council have since released a statement outlining what they believe he's done wrong. and including some quotes from various communications with members of the community council. And it's all got a bit horrible, really.
Yeah, it's a horrible mess. It's a real shame because there's a whole bunch of people on the community council who are community people. There's been a lot of talk that this is Canonical trying to silence Riddell because Riddell's asking awkward questions, which is just wrong. The people who are on the community council are a mix of community people and Canonical people. There's a few Canonical people on there. One of them is Mark, who's got a permanent position on the community council, and Daniel Holbach and Michael Hall are both on there as well. And then there's a whole bunch of community people as well. And the way it comes across is they're punishing Jonathan. The way some people see it is they're punishing Jonathan because he's been asking awkward questions. Whereas the way they're describing it is they're punishing him for the way he's asking the questions and the relentless way he's been badgering the community council
the way that he has not accepted their responses to his questions as well.
Right. And part of the problem is that Canonical have in some ways screwed up the finances that were generated through the donations screen that was part of the download, right? That's Canonical screw up. That's very clear. But the community council are not able to reach into the finance department of Canonical and start rifling through paperwork and looking through, you know, and audit things. That's not their remit, and they're not empowered to do that kind of thing. You could argue Mark is, given he owns the company and he's on the CC. You know, he could probably reach into those departments. And I don't know what input he's had inside Canonical, whether he has, you know, poked the relevant people or said, you know, you guys need to... I just don't know.
And that's the issue, though. You don't know, I don't know, nobody knows, because there hasn't been any transparency with this whole situation. Well, there's been very little transparency.
With which bits? There's a lot of communication, and there's been some transparency in some places, like conversations on IRC and, you know, mails to various mailing lists. Some of it is open. Some of it isn't. You know, which bit is, you know, so the bits that are not open, like the communication between the members of the community council. Disclosure: I've been on the community council 3 years ago. I was on the community council.
What? And, right, you're no longer able to be part of this discussion, Alan. You're clearly on their side.
And while I was on there, you know, we'd have private conversations on a private mailing list, and then we'd, you know, have a discussion in the same way that any other group of people would have a private conversation and then, you know, make an announcement once we've formulated our answer. And that's exactly what the community council have done. But I think the Kubuntu council are upset that there was no reaching out from the community council to the Kubuntu council to say, hey, look, we've got this problem with Jonathan. Can you help us sort it out? There seemed to be like a straw that broke the camel's back, and a bunch of people on the community council decided, do you know what? We've had enough of this. You know, we're doing our best. We're volunteers. We're not paid for this, and we're doing our absolute best to deal with this. But that guy is actually not helping. And that's how it feels to me, the way that it's come across. That's how it feels. Whether that's right or wrong, I don't know. What do you think?
The thing is with... Oh, sorry, Joe, you
no,
go.
No, you go for it, Mark.
Okay. Well, I think the thing about the whole private-public thing is it's only a problem, and this always seems to be the way when Canonical is accused of doing bad things, is it's only a problem if you assume the worst possible behaviour on the part of the people involved. So if you assume that when they're discussing things in public, it's because they're saying something horrible or they're covering something up, which I don't tend to do. You know, I don't tend to assume that, you know, when Canonical add Amazon search to the thing, it's because they want to harvest all of your data in your searches. I don't assume that when people are discussing, you know, how to get this, what financial information they can get, it's because they know that it's all evil and they're going to try and cover it all up. And it seems to me that you know, the only reason that you'd paint this in a bad light is if you're assuming that everyone involved is evil.
Are healthy. You can't always trust everyone. You can't presume that they're always doing the right thing. Equally, you can't realistically live with a tinfoil hat on and assume the worst all the time. And so there has to be some way of describing the way in which that team should operate in a way that is clear to everyone. And I mean, the fact is that the community council operate in that they have a private mailing list. And also, you know, even if they didn't have a private mailing list, you can guarantee that one person on the community council pings another person on the community council and has a private conversation with them. You can't prohibit private conversations between individuals that are in a leadership team. That's just unreasonable.
Hmm. When you are asked to provide evidence of bad behavior and violations of the code of conduct, surely that's a fairly easy thing to do. And why did it take them so long to provide the evidence? And then why was it so scant when they did?
Well, as I understand it, the details that have gone to the... So there was a mail that was sent that's public, which has, you know, a kind of high-level summary that everyone has seen. But then the Kubuntu Council asked for more detail. And so the Community Council sent a mail, which they announced that they have sent the mail on fridge.ubuntu.com and the community team mailing list, with lots more detail. And apparently that took a long time to compile, because you've got to go back through 3 or 2 years worth of emails in order to compile all the individual occasions, because they wanted a full account of all the interactions, all the issues that the community council were annoyed at. And so, yeah, that took them some time. And like I say, they're all volunteers. It's their full-time job. They've all got full-time jobs and they do the community council stuff in their spare time. Like everyone,
podcasting isn't your full-time job.
Well, so I feel sorry for the community council in some ways, because I feel bad that they're the brunt of all these people who are attacking them. But I know what it's like on the community council mailing list, that you there's a lot of hand-wringing going on that list of, are we doing the right thing? And always checking to make sure you're doing the right thing. It's never that they conspire to kick someone out or, right, this guy, we've had enough of this guy, let's just get rid of him. They let it go on for a very long time, as they've explained, before, yeah, there was a straw that broke the camel's back at whatever time. So I feel bad for them, but equally I feel bad for the Kubuntu Community Council because they've got no heads up of this. Yeah. It just feels like bad in every way. And they, you know, they all need to get into a room and like talk it through, whatever kind of room that is, virtual or real, and talk it through, because there's stalemates on both sides and there's frustrations on both sides and there's strong opinions on both sides. It's not an easy one. It's not as simple as, you know, Joe committed a dodgy patch, so someone else has got to revert it. It's deeper than that, and it's been going on for longer than that. And so it needs a lot of care. And I hope that the Community Council and the Kubuntu Community Council don't have any knee-jerk reactions. Some would say kicking Jonathan out was a knee-jerk reaction. I don't think it was, but... don't have any knee-jerk reactions and, you know, make this worse.
But haven't we got a situation now where, because they've been so adamant and Shuttleworth has weighed in and said that he's definitely got to step down, Riddell, that there's no way they can go back on that. And if the Kubuntu Council are adamant that they won't accept that, then there's just no way to solve this apart from Kubuntu breaking away and probably having to rebrand as something else. I mean,
I think there's other more creative ways they can deal with this. I can see why Mark has stood by the community council, because the whole point of the community council is that top tier where they can arbitrate problems between one team and another, or an individual and another, or an individual and a team. And under normal circumstances, what happens is, you know, someone has a problem let's say, on IRC, and they go to the IRC ops, and then that goes up to the IRC council, and they don't deal with it, so it goes up to the community council. And under normal circumstances, the community council are arbitrating between an individual and a team. But this is very different. This is the community council themselves being the brunt of what they're seeing as an attack, or whatever you want to call it. And so they're having to arbitrate their own situation. And I'm sure that's partly why they took such a long time about, you know, making this decision. So it's kind of unprecedented in Ubuntu for the community council to be the ones under attack. And that makes it even harder. But I do think that they're creative individuals. And I think there are people on the Kubuntu side who are creative, well-meaning, friendly individuals who want to come to a solution. And I'm pretty sure they can. This isn't Israel-Palestine. It's not Northern Ireland and Republic of Ireland. It's two teams where there's, you know, one guy who's been seen as unreasonable, and one team don't want to deal with that person. And that's unfortunate. And I know that a lot of people complained that this was done in private, and the mail was sent, you know, to the Kubuntu Community Council in private. But, you know, if you were working and some team publicly posted on a mailing list that you suck in some way, and here's a list of the ways in which you suck, that is horrible. Yeah. You know,
for your definitely not the right way of doing it. They couldn't have just gone to OMG Ubuntu and said, here's a news story for you. We don't like this guy.
Yeah.
Could they? What could they have done other than the way they did it, really?
Exactly. And that's why I find they're in a hard place. And I, you know, I feel bad for them. I work with two of them, Daniel and Mike. You know, I know they've been working so hard the last week. You know, even though they're not paid to work on the community council, you know, they've been spending hours and hours and hours replying to emails, replying to, like, you know, Twitter, Google Plus, answering comments on news articles and stuff. I feel bad for them because they've got to deal with this. And yes, I feel bad for Riddell as well. But, you know, someone's got to resolve this. And I think it's got to be between the Kubuntu Council and the Ubuntu Council, really.
Well, if you've got any thoughts on this issue,
don't tell us.
Don't tell us. Show at ubuntupodcast.org. And that's all for episode 13. We'll be back next week when we'll have an interview and we'll bring you some command line love.
So, Joe, do you want to come back next week and join us for another episode?
Yeah, why not?
Brilliant.
You're a good man. Thank you so
much.
We'll
see you then.
Yes. Yes. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
See you next week at the same time.
Well, not at the same time. You'll just download it whenever you get it, really.
Well, it depends when you listen to it. Yeah. Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye. Stop recording.